Here in the third hour of the program, we're going to be talking about profanity. Those four-letter words, all sorts of words that you can't say. Right where I'm sitting here right now, people who do generally get paid a lot of money to say them on XM radio, things like that. Well, we're going to be talking about also this poll that, if it is to be believed, and I imagine it probably is, it seems to square with my experience. Nearly three-quarters of Americans questioned last week, 74% that is, said that they encounter profanity in public frequently or occasionally, and many of those say that they're also using profanity more and more as time goes by. Now, we could talk about how coarse public discourse has become in America, but let's focus on the second commandment. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Does it apply to this situation? Our guest here in the third hour of the program to talk about this new poll on profanity and the second commandment, Dr. David Adams, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He is author of the forthcoming commentary in the Concordia Commentary Series on the Book of Genesis. Dr. Adams, welcome back.
Great to be here.
All right, so if 75% of Americans say that they're encountering profanity in the public place, are we experiencing here in America a widespread epidemic breaking of the second commandment, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain?
Oh, we're certainly experiencing a widespread breaking of the second commandment against taking God's name in vain. Whether there's any connection between that and the use of common vulgarity is another question. But there's no doubt that we all experience probably and encounter the breaking of the commandment against taking God's name in vain on a regular basis.
Okay, so the use of the four-letter word, the proverbial four-letter word, is not necessarily a breaking of the second commandment?
Not directly, no. Oh, perhaps only by application in a secondary sense. But no, there's no, the commandment against taking God's name in vain has nothing to do with common vulgarity of speech.
So the four-letter word, what does God speak to when he says, you shall not take the name of the Lord in vain? What is he properly speaking to?
Well, let me just respond in two ways. One, by simply repeating what Luther said at the beginning of his explanation in the Large Catechism. And then I'd like to spend a little more time sort of showing how Luther understands it correctly. So Luther says, regarding this commandment, that just as the first commandment instructs the heart and teaches faith, so this commandment leads us outward and directs the lips and tongue into a right relationship with God. That's the issue about which this commandment deals. It is the use of ourselves, and as James says in the New Testament, nothing represents us and ourselves more clearly than the way we speak. And so it's the use of ourselves as characterized by our tongue in a way that worships God rightly.
Now, many Christians would be shocked to hear you say that the second commandment, properly speaking, doesn't really address itself to common profanity, to vulgarity, to four-letter words. Are there any scriptures that do, that would caution the Christian or warn the Christian or forbid the Christian from using the so-called four-letter words?
Oh, certainly. In the New Testament, for example, like Colossians 4:6, let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to speak to each person. And there's some others that, you know, warn against generally speaking behavior that would bring the gospel into disrepute. And this is the real point in the New Testament verses that deal with this. It's not when the New Testament talks about our use of the tongue and language in a sense that might be referring to vulgarity. It doesn't cite the commandment against taking God's name in vain. It says that we ought to use our tongue in a way that honors God so that we don't bring the gospel into disrepute, because those around us hear and see the witness of our lives, and rightly or wrongly judge the gospel on the basis of what they see in us. Now, we know that's not fair. It's not fair to God. It's not fair to the gospel. But nonetheless, it's what happens in the real world. And so when the scriptures tell us, to guard our tongue and the way that we speak, to let our speech be gracious, as Paul says in Colossians 4:6 and other places similarly, he's guiding us so that we may know how to live, that we don't bring the gospel into disrepute.
Okay, we do have to clear up one thing before we go any farther. As we talk about the second commandment, many people will say, you seem to be operating with some sort of poor numbering system. Many would think that the second commandment has to do with graven images, but the numbering system we use, if you would just explain kind of this, the more traditional widespread way of numbering the commandments that many Christians in America are familiar with.
Right. There are, to keep it simple, there are three ways of numbering the Ten Commandments. There's the way that's most common in the Jewish tradition, which is to divide what we call the first table of the law into five commandments, and then the second table of the law into five. So in this case, verse 2 of Exodus, "I am Yahweh your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt," counts as the first commandment. Keep in mind that the word for these commandments in Hebrew is not the Hebrew word mitzvot, that means commandment. It's the word devarim, which means something like a statement or a principle. The ten words, the ten sayings, the ten principles. So the fact that Exodus 22 in the Jewish tradition is the first commandment, although it's not in the form of a command, it's not a problem. It's a statement of principle.
Yes.
And so in the Jewish tradition, you've got five and five. In the older and more widespread Christian tradition, that observed by Catholics, by the Orthodox, and by Lutherans, the numbering system is to have the first three commandments be the so-called first table of law, and then the second table of law beginning with the commandment related to parents, dealing with horizontal relationships. In that tradition of numbering, so the problem is if you actually start counting the commandments, you can come up with as few as eight or nine and as many as about 13. The one number you really can't come up with easily is 10. And Scripture never actually refers to them as 10 commandments. Twice in the Old Testament, the phrase, the 10 devarim, the 10 words, occur. But in neither place is it really clear that it's talking about Exodus 20 there when that phrase is used. Now, we assume that it is, and we call it the 10 commandments. And it's always been my view that the reason we like to organize these into 10 Exodus 20 into 10 is for didactic purposes. It's easy to teach children things with 10 because you can count them on their fingers, especially in an older age when people didn't have books and so forth.
So the numbering, however it is numbered, as long as something isn't left out, the numbering is really neither here nor there.
That's right. There are certain theological presuppositions that shape the numbering. For example, in the Jewish tradition, In an ironic way, the Jewish tradition emphasizes the gospel more than the Christian tradition does, because it begins with the redemptive statement, "I am Yahweh your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt." So it begins the ten principles for life in the presence of Yahweh with the recognition that it begins with God's act, not ours. So in an ironic way, the Christian tradition, both the Lutheran Catholic Orthodox and the Protestant tradition that numbers them 4 and 6, which is the one that most Americans will be most familiar with. Both of those traditions, in a very ironic way, omit the gospel in Exodus 20 and focus on the law in the narrow sense there. So there are some theological issues related to the numbering. I kind of find myself liking the Jewish tradition because it emphasizes the gospel. But then again, I'm an Old Testament prof, so what do you expect?
Well, before we come back to the four-letter words,
yes,
let's deal with what the second commandment about the Lord's name does properly give to Christians. Luther's explanation is that we should not misuse the fear and love God so that we not curse, swear, lie, or deceive by his name, but call upon it in every trouble, pray, praise, and give thanks. Simple explanation to this. He focuses upon the name of God itself. What does it mean to curse by God's name?
Well, let me back up just a bit and actually talk about Exodus 20, verse 7, if we'll have a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. And here, I apologize, we'll have to talk a little bit about Hebrew. Because
that's fine.
One of the problems with understanding the commandment, Exodus 27, is the fact that we're reading it in English translation. And because we're reading it in an English translation, we miss the significance of certain words in the text. So the Hebrew text says, "Lo tisha," you shall not lift up, Et Shem Yahweh, the name of Yahweh, your God, Lashau, like a shall. And I'm going to leave that word untranslated for a moment. Well, two things to recognize here. The entire context of the first part of the Ten Commandments has to deals with worship, what we call the First Commandment, or in the Protestant tradition, the First and Second Commandments, deal with how God should not be worshipped, namely by using graven images, the way that other gods are worshipped, using false images and idols. If we look at what follows this commandment, we see that the next commandment is about the Sabbath day. And there we get a long explanation, beginning with Exodus 20, verse 8, that goes on for a bit about observing the Sabbath day. The point is that that gives us the positive thing, how God should be worshipped. He should be worshipped as the one who has created the world and set aside a day of rest to typify his redemptive work, in which the people of God are redeemed and enter into his rest.
So those two commands are two sides of one coin, the worship coin kind of a thing.
That's correct. Right. And in fact, what we call the second commandment, Exodus 20, verse 7, is the end of the discussion about how God should not be worshipped. But the first thing to see is that the whole context is about worship and worship alone. Now, what does this say in that context? The word nasa in Hebrew, the word we translate lift up, the word nasa can be used generally simply to mean pick up, like I picked up a book, or you know, I picked up my wife after work. I physically lift something up or to collect it. But it's also used in a more strictly theological sense to forgive. God takes away, lifts up sin.
Lift off a burden.
That's correct. But it's also used in worship context quite often. You'll know this if you think about it, because we hear it in phrases like lift up your heart, lift up your voice, and so forth. These are all various ways of as euphemisms talking about worship. And here, to lift up the name of Yahweh is a worship statement. He's saying, in effect, you shall not worship Yahweh. To say you shall not lift up the name of Yahweh means you shall not worship Yahweh.
Maybe the term we might use, it's not perfect, but is exalt.
Exalt, or perhaps invoke, something like that, too. So, to invoke in worship.
So you shall not lift up the name of Yahweh, God,
right?
Like what?
Like a shall. Okay. Well, shall is another, this word doesn't occur a lot in the Old Testament. It means, on one level, often words, have more generic meanings and more strictly theological meanings. On the more generic level, a shall is a piece of trash. It's a piece of junk. It's something that has no value. It's worthless. And it's used sort of as an adverb in Hebrew. Hebrew uses a lot of nouns like adverbs. And if you do something in a worthless way, you see, you do it to no effect or to no avail. Or, as we might say, to do it in vain. And that's what we have here. We have this noun used that way. But here's the catch. When this word is used in worship context, it's used as a euphemism for false gods. In Jonah chapter 2, in about half a dozen places in the Old Testament, shall is used as a euphemism, as a term to refer to false gods. There's another word in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word kevel, which means a breath. Something insubstantial that's used in the same way. In worship context, it's used, and twice the two words are actually used together.
So if you think about all that the Old Testament has to say about false gods and the use of idols, it is very often the charge against the false god, the idol, is that they are nothing, empty, hollow, useless, I think is one of the terms that comes up an awful lot.
Right.
That's all kind of rolled together in the context of this one word when it comes to worship.
That's correct. And that's what's being said here. You shall not, in effect, if we were going to translate this with regard to its meaning, to communicate its meaning effectively, we might translate Exodus 27 to mean in some way like this. We might say, you shall not worship Yahweh your God like a false god is worshipped. And that's what it says. And as I said, this concludes the discussion of the way Yahweh shouldn't be worshipped, using idols and so forth in the preceding verses. And then we go on in the next verse to talk about the other side of the coin, about the way Yahweh should be worshipped.
So the context for do not take the name of the Lord your God in vain is When you are worshiping your God, who your God is, we tell you in the first commandment, no other gods besides me. Make no graven images, something on the earth, something above the earth. In summary, don't worship God like you would a false god or as a false god.
That's right. You know, don't worship him with idols. Don't worship in any way that false gods would be worshipped.
Okay.
Now, one of the ways that gods are worshipped in the ancient world is to invoke them in oaths. To, as we might say, to swear by them, to take an oath using them. Because, you see, in the ancient world, and outside the Bible, there's a, throughout the ancient Near East, magic is a very important part of worship. And the reason for that is they believed that, for reasons that we probably don't have time to go into here, they believed that what happened in the realm of, in the God's realm, affected what happens here.
A sympathetic relationship.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And what happens here affects what happens in the realm of the God. So you can, if you call upon the name of a God, if you use the name of a God in an oath, you are binding that God to do something. And so oath-taking is a regular worship act throughout the ancient Near East and in the Old Testament. And that's why the Bible regularly guards it, warns us not to go around taking oaths in a careless sort of way. Particularly not when you're using God's name. And that's the connection, you see. And it's the connection that Luther makes in the Large Catechism as well, to get back to where we started this question, that we should not take oaths or swear using the name of God falsely. Because if we do that, we're saying that God is nothing but a worthless idol. Mm-hmm. He's just like a shall, see. He's empty, he's meaningless, and so he can call upon his name in an empty, meaningless way.
So the two terms that Luther uses is curse, swear. Curse here means to, is in effect, cursing and swearing are two variations on an oath.
Well, that's right. One is to curse is to call upon God to act against someone. Mm-hmm. So it's a worship act. In fact, in the ancient Near East, you know, something that archaeologists find all the time when they're digging around temples are these little pieces of pottery with curses written on them. And it was quite common, both in Mesopotamia and in Egypt, that you write the name of somebody that you want bad things to happen to, and you go to the temple and you pay, you know, your offering or take your offering, and then you take the piece of pottery and you break it. And it's sort of sympathetic magic. You want God to do the same thing. That's a curse, whether you do it using a piece of pottery or whether you call the wrath of God down upon someone. That's a curse. And to swear, then, is, again, to call God as a witness that what you say is true. And, of course, if you call God as a witness to something that's false, you're, in effect, saying, you know, to call God as a witness is a meaningless act because he has no power.
And you're really, in effect, making God complicitous in your lie.
Yes, you are. And you're declaring, at least in your own heart, that you don't believe in God. You don't believe that God will do anything to you if you call upon mm-hmm. him in, you know.
So you have the kind of quintessential picture of the inveterate liar who will, after issuing his string of falsehoods, say, as God is my witness, may he strike me dead. Something along those lines. It's a comical way of describing exactly what God is asking and telling us not to do here.
That's correct. And if you look at Luther's larger explanation in the Large Catechism, he deals most of the time with the issue of lying. That's what the bulk of his explanation in the Large Catechism is about.
Well, before we go to the break, since we've raised the issue of oaths, most of the time we will think in our modern context, Dr. Adams, about an oath being more or less a legal act, a civil act that
yes.
takes place in the courtroom, at the DMV, perhaps in front of a judge or a justice of the peace, or a notary. Today I went to the bank. I wrote a check. I signed my name. Now, legally, it's a form of oath, a pledge to pay. Are Christians forbidden to do any type of oath-taking by the Second Commandment?
No, they're not. In the New Testament, Jesus says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. What he's there, again, warning us against is the danger of not taking seriously the vow that we make before God. But in fact, if you look at the New Testament, Christians in the New Testament do make affirmative statements that we would call oaths. And not only that, Christians are obligated to take such oaths as the government requires, as long as they can do so without breaking the mm-hmm. commandment, you know, do so in a false way. And so Christians are not absolutely forbidden to take oaths. They're simply warned that when they take oaths, they are indeed calling upon God to be their witness. And if they take that oath falsely, if they lie in that oath, they're in effect declaring, I don't believe in God. I don't believe he has any power to judge me. It's really a denial of God in one's own heart.
Well, if a president is being sworn in, he will end not according to the constitutional text, but according to custom, so help me God. Does the man put himself in danger of calling God's wrath upon himself by uttering these words?
Absolutely. He puts his eternal immortal soul and body in the judgment seat because he's called God to be his witness that he will do these things. And if he does not do them and does not do them in the way that he's vowed to do them, then he's calling the wrath of God down upon himself.
The pastor, I did this 15-some-odd years ago, taking my ordination vow. I was asked point-blank before my congregation what I believed, how I would conduct my ministry. There was a very particular thing. And then, do you intend to do this? Will you do this? And my response was, yes, with God helping me. And I invoked the help of God to the end of that vow. I take that vow very seriously. Did I make a mistake in doing this?
No. In this case, you stated your intention. This is what I intend to do, and ask God to help you to do it. That's, mm-hmm. in a sense, not the same kind of vow that we're talking about. You're stating your intention there to do it, and you're asking for God's help to fulfill your intention. You're not there taking an oath that something you have said is true. I mean, you stated, yes, I truly intend to do this, but that's different from saying, I affirm that when I say X, I'm telling the truth.
Putting the hand on the Bible, I've heard Christians say, look, I have no problem swearing an oath, but I'm not going to put my hand on the Bible and do it. Or some Christians will alternatively say, when I swear my oath in the courtroom, I'm going to put my hand on that Bible. I've sworn oaths in courtrooms when I've testified and when I've given depositions and things like that. Are these, and no God was invoked, are these also covered under the Second Commandment?
I don't think it makes any difference with regard to the commandment whether you put your hand on the Bible or not. In some ways, for a Christian, putting your hand on a Bible serves as a salutary reminder of the seriousness of what you're doing. So in that sense, as a reminder, as an act that reminds me of the seriousness of what I'm doing, it's probably a good thing.
When we come back from this break, we're going to continue our conversation, the last half hour of Issues Etc. today and the last live hour this week. Dr. David Adams is our guest. We're talking about this new poll on profanity and the Second Commandment. When we come back, we will get to those four-letter words. Stay tuned.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The joyful cry of Easter. He is risen. He is risen indeed. The death and resurrection of Jesus Christ is the good news that stands at the heart of the Christian faith. And the story of his death and resurrection stands at the center of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March. It's called He is Risen Indeed. It's a children's book, beautifully illustrated, telling the story of Jesus' death and resurrection for us sinners. You can purchase He is Risen Indeed from Concordia Publishing House, their number 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. You can also browse before you buy. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and find the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, He is Risen Indeed. The book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Or call 1-800-325-3040.
Life on Mars, now Life on Europa.
Answers with Ken Ham, whose ministry is building a large creation museum and planetarium near Cincinnati, Ohio. Ken, we all heard the stir about supposed life on Mars coming on that meteorite, but that's now been rejected. What's the new idea about?
Well, Europa is one of Jupiter's moons. Not long ago, news reports around the world declared that scientists had found evidence of possible life on Europa. You know, evolutionists are so desperate to prove that there's life in outer space, it seems to me they're making more and more wild, desperate claims. And these are then later proven to be false. The reason they're so desperate is because they believe if they can find life elsewhere in the universe, not only would this support the idea that life evolved beyond Earth, but this would undermine the Bible. It would mean life on Earth wasn't special. Now consider how desperate they really are. Scientists said that photographs of Europa showed images that might be ice, and they suspect that there might be liquid water under the ice, and after all, if there just might be water, there just might be life. Surely people can see the foolishness of man as he desperately tries to disregard the truth of the Bible and reject God. No life is special, created by the God of the Bible.
Our website contains all kinds of intriguing information on the topic of astronomy and the Bible. Just go to our site, answersradio.com, for answers. That's answersradio.com.
Larry Rast, Arthur Just, Carl Fakencher, Kurt Marquardt, Peter Scare, Cameron McKenzie.
You probably recognize these names as regular guests on Issues Etc. But what else do they have in common? Well, they're all members of the Christ-centered, cross-focused faculty of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Dean Wenthe, Walter A. Meyer II, David Scare, Dan Gard, Charles Geeshan, Bill Weinrich.
Have you ever considered the pastoral ministry? Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call them 1-800-481-2155. Preparing Christ-centered, cross-focused pastors for the 21st century. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
John Pless, Hal Senkbeil, Richard Muller, Roland Ziegler.
It was focused on the family's first abstinence curriculum, Sex, Lies, and the Truth, written by Amy Stevens. Dr. James Dobson welcomes Amy and Dr. Joe McElhaney into the studio for an honest discussion about the consequences of risky sexual behavior.
We've got a generation now that's becoming out of touch with what their feelings are and problems when it comes time to really bond.
On the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
My goodness, folks, if I could just let you hear for a moment the words that were flying around this studio in between the breaks. All sorts of words that can't be said on the air. We weren't having fun with it necessarily, but a conversation that will necessarily, in a more sanitized form, ensue as our conversation with Dr. David Adams continues about this new poll on profanity and the Second Commandment. Now, I want to pick up where we left off before we move on to the four-letter words. We dealt with curse and swear. Let's deal with lie and deceive, because Luther says this also has to do with lying and deceiving by God's name. This is strictly forbidden, and it is connected to the use of God's name. Can you give us an example of what we're talking about here?
Well, Luther connects these with oaths, because when Luther makes the point in the Large Catechism that it's always a sin to lie, whether you use God's name or not. You know, the devil is the father of lies. God is the one who is true. So anytime we lie, whether we use God's name or not, we are in effect declaring our allegiance with the devil rather than with God. But it's especially sinful when we lie in God's name, because now we're in effect calling God the devil. We're in effect saying there's no difference between God and the devil. We are saying, you know, not only do I align myself with him, I align God with him. And so that's why it's doubly grievous.
Luther says in the Larger Catechism that the most common and the most troubling breaking of the Second Commandment, you wouldn't even think. He says it comes from the pulpit, and it comes from the pastors and teachers of the church when false doctrine, false teaching is proclaimed in God's name. Why does he consider this such a serious violation of the Second Commandment?
Well, first, because it's saying that God has said something he didn't, it's making of God a liar. So in one sense, You know, it's doing the same thing as lying in the name of God. It's saying that God has said something that he has not said. But there, even that sin is compounded yet again because it leads others into falsehood. It detracts from the gospel. To teach falsely not only undermines the gospel, but it leads others to believe falsely as well.
So there's some guy standing on the street corner uttering a string of four-letter words, not taking the name of the Lord in vain per se, but mm-hmm. uttering a string of four-letter words for whatever reason.
Let's say he dropped his groceries and broke yeah. his thing of milk.
Yeah, okay. And then there's the preacher in the pulpit uttering all sorts of nonsense and saying, "Thus saith the Lord." God has a more serious problem with the preacher in the pulpit than the guy on the street corner.
The preacher in the pulpit who preaches false doctrine in God's name has sinned grievously against God. The man on the street corner who dropped his bag and broke his, you know, milk jar or whatever and utters a common vulgarity is simply rude. He's not sinning at all unless he invokes God's name. But if he's just uttering common vulgarities, he's not sinning. Now, he may be, if he's a Christian, he may be bringing his Christian witness into disrepute. That's a separate issue.
I mean, Jesus talks about idle speech. The Sixth Commandment talks about chaste in word and deed.
That's correct.
So there may be other problems.
There are other problems, but it's not the second command. It's not the commandment against taking God's name in vain problem.
Okay, so that leads us to this point. You say that we often confuse cultural mores and taboos with Christian sanctification, the Christian life. What do you mean?
Well, let me give you an example. Since we were talking about preachers, I'll give you two examples from preaching, one from my own life and one that I just ran into a week or so ago. I'll start with my own life. A couple of years ago, I happened to be preaching a sermon at a particular church as a guest preacher, and the subject was a particular kind of sin. And I said from the pulpit that those who commit this sin are damned to hell. And I think that's the exact phrase I used. Mm-hmm. And there are two services at this church. And in between the services, one of the elders came up to me and he said, "You know, I really wish you'd change what you said before the second service." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And he said, "You know, you said this would be damned to hell." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well..." He said, "I don't want my kids hearing language like that from the pulpit." What can you say? I mean, this is the language that the Bible itself uses, and I was using it in a theologically correct way. But you see, we become so hypersensitive to the cultural significance of certain words that we've lost them.
Okay, so damn and hell. And to my listeners who will email me and say, "I heard Wilkins say that," consider my context, please.
You can just blame it on me, adamsd@csl.edu.
But these two thoroughly biblical words used in their proper biblical context, Jesus talks about those who utter the curse are in danger of the hellfire. And Paul says, "Let the one who preaches the gospel falsely be anathema," which is kind of damned. A fancy way of saying damned.
That's right. That's the King James or Victorian way of saying damned, because we don't want to say damned.
So what's your other story? Tell your other story
other
that
story.
Illustrates the point.
Well, similarly, a very, very similar kind of story. And this happened 2 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago now, here in a congregation in Missouri, not in St. Louis. Another guest preacher who was preaching, and I forget the text, but he was dealing with the fact that Jesus was born. He was talking about the virgin birth, Christ was born of Mary by the power of the Holy Spirit, not through the agency of man. And he said that people who would look on and see this, would think that Mary was a whore and that Jesus was a bastard. He was using those terms again in the technical sense.
And two words in our culture that still reside upon the periphery of the taboo.
That's correct. And the point here was that, you know, they knew Mary wasn't married, and yet she was pregnant, and so they would think that she was sexually profligate and that Jesus would be born outside of wedlock. Now, the aftermath of this is the pastor who was out of town, who's the person who told me the story. I heard it from the pastor. got complaints all the following week about this terrible preacher who had come in, who said all these bad words and must be a terrible, terrible person. And in fact, he's one of the most pious and saintly men that I know. And because I do happen to know him, and I won't say his name, but he's one of the most pious and godly men I know. And yet people make the judgment not because the words themselves are bad. In fact, there's no such thing, here, let me say this slowly, there's no such thing as a bad word. There are only words that are used in bad ways.
Give me an example.
Well, I don't know how explicit you want me to be on the radio. I don't know what the FCC rules are these days.
Well, so. Let's just assume they're extremely strict.
Okay.
And say, here's a good example. There are all sorts of words that we use, Dr. Adams, to refer to what comes out of the back end of the cow.
Okay.
Right? So we could say manure.
Right.
It's fairly descriptive, right?
Right. And that's the word that most people don't regard as vulgar.
We'll say cow pie. Then we get into the more technical kind of medical terms like feces or excrement.
Mm-hmm.
Any different as words from the S word?
No. They all mean the same thing. Now, one of them... what you so euphemistically described as the S word, is a little more, shall we say, Anglo-Saxon. But they all mean the same thing. One is not, the only reason we think of one as bad and the others as acceptable is that we've been culturally conditioned in that way. It's the words themselves mean exactly the same thing. There's no difference in them. One is not better than another per se. It's just that we've attached a certain cultural value to one that we haven't attached to the other, and it's the cultural value that we're talking about when we say a word is bad.
Well, I've been reading a book on the construction, this century-long writing of the Oxford English Dictionary. Fascinating book.
Oh, I have to read it.
It's called The Meaning of Everything. I'll lend it to you.
Yeah, I've got the OED, by the way. Yeah. Not the full size set, but the edition that comes with a microscope so you can read the text in
well,
three volumes.
Well, one of the things that came across in this that they wanted to catalog the entire English language in its entirety perfectly. And in doing so, they had to decide whether they're going to put profanity in there. And, of course, the man who did it said, of course we are. It's part of our language. And some of the words that made it in there as profane, they'll put a little mark on it, a profanity or vulgarity, today are considered, or don't have that sign on them, like the S word. In the first edition, was not considered to be profane in common parlance. And then in later editions, it is. So it appears that the word hasn't changed, but our view towards such words definitely has changed.
That's exactly right. Our cultural value shift, words that we think of as bad words in one generation, either we don't know them or at all, or their cultural value, their cultural evaluation changes. But it's not the word that's bad. It's simply our attitude toward the word.
Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Just about 15 minutes left in our conversation, live this Thursday, the 30th of March, with Dr. David Adams on a new poll on profanity and the Second Commandment. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. By the way, you will not hear a conversation like this anywhere else on Christian radio, for sure. I mean, if you want to hear the four-letter words and the vulgarities, you can tune in any place. But approached this way, I doubt you'll hear it anyplace else. Okay, so another example there of confusing cultural mores and taboos with Christian sanctification. What about those admonitions in Scripture? And they are replete against idle chatter, useless words. Jesus talks about one of the things that proceeds out of the heart of sinful man is filthy talk.
Right.
And when it comes to kind of the more sexually oriented language that is often used, Luther says that the Sixth Commandment, in addition to forbidding adultery, calls for chastity in all aspects of our life. Would you address that, if you would?
Certainly. And you hit it, I think, when you cited the verse, which makes it clear to us that it's what the fact that what comes out of our mouth is sort of a thermometer that measures our heart. But again, it's the content that we're talking about, not the social value of words. So if I use words that show disdain for God's gift of sexuality, then it's not the words that are the problem. It's my disdain of God's gift of sexuality that's the problem. If I use words that might call the gospel into disrepute because they are vulgar, it's not the words that are sinful. It's my disregard of the gospel that's the problem.
Jesus says, if you call your brother fool, that's not a bad word. We use it all the time. You are guilty of sinning against your brother. Tantamount to murder, he says. So what comes out of our mouth really does matter for other reasons.
It does, yeah, and don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. When I'm saying it's not a violation of the commandment against taking God's name in vain, I'm not saying that it's a good thing. I'm simply saying it's a different kind of bad thing.
Let's talk with Jason, who calls from his car. Jason, thank you very much for waiting, and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you.
Hi.
I guess I'm just wondering, as Christians, even though these words are just words, and they just have attached meaning that we've given them as a culture, I'm just wondering, how do we address the cultural meaning? For example, God bless you is something I've seen in my life where people were upset with me in church for not saying God bless you after you sneeze.
Hmm. Okay. Thank you very much, Jason. Dr. Adams, your thoughts on this?
Well, the danger here is that all of these kinds of things where we call upon God can become meaningless, sort of like the have a nice day, which I was in a grocery store not too long ago. Someone said, checker said, have a nice day, as I left. And I said, hand, H-A-N-D, have a nice day, hand. That's my response. Hand to you also. and they look at me and I think, well, obviously what I said is meaningless to you because what you said is meaningless to me. We say those things, they're courtesies. I've sometimes replied, someone says, have a nice day, and I've sometimes replied, may you have exactly what you wish to me. In other words, they really are not wishing me a nice day, sincerely.
They're just, it's
a courtesy.
Right, empty courtesies.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is, what if you invoke God in a way that's an empty courtesy? What if you say, God bless you? And you really don't mean it. I mean, you really aren't thinking about God at all. You are, in effect, taking the name of God in vain.
What about goodbye, which would be God be with you?
Yeah, well, that's you're right. That you're quite correct. Goodbye is a abbreviated form of God be with you. That, I think, is not because we don't even know what we're saying there. We don't know until we just, you and I just said that, probably 90% of the people listening to us had no idea that when they were saying goodbye, they were saying God be with you. It's just a abbreviated form of that. So they're not taking God's name in vain because they're not using the name of God there at all. They're unaware of it. Any more than the fact that today is, what, Thursday? What is Thursday? Where did that come
from? It's Thursday.
Thursday.
It's a Norse and then going all the way back to those Germanic people.
Today is the day of the Norse god Thor. Now, when producer called me and said, you want to come on the radio on Thursday? It didn't occur to me that he meant, you want to come on the day in which we here at KFUO worship Thor? You see, words also lose their value as well. And what the second commandment is concerned with is that the name of God not lose its value, that it be worshiped rightly, and that it be used in a true and worshipful way. So in some ways, it's worse to say God bless you in a meaningless, empty sort of way, because there you do know you're calling upon God, unlike goodbye where you don't even know you're doing it. You do know it. And to do that in an empty way is worse than to stub your toe and say some common vulgarity.
It strikes me, this is very odd, but my brother spent a year in Iraq with the U.S. Army, not by choice, but they kind of asked him if he would. And he dealt as an officer with contractors, with merchants, and all sorts of things on a daily basis. And he said a very common Iraqi greeting, and I don't remember what it was, is Iraqi ejection. They use it whenever they say anything. Is in English, if Allah wills.
Inshallah.
Inshallah. He said it's constant, but he said if I used it, they were angry with me.
Because
they could use it. This was their God. They were talking about Allah. Allah permeates their life. Dare not I, a Christian, use that language. That, to them, was tantamount to using Allah's name in vain.
Right. And it would be, in the strict sense, because I don't think that Allah has any value as a God. He's an empty, phony, false God. He's an idol. He's nothing but a demon at best.
And you wouldn't be saying inshallah to anybody nowadays because you do not believe in Allah.
That's correct. But if I said it to you and you were Muslim, you, because I'm a Christian, you would know that I was, in fact, using it in an empty way. So they'd be right to be offended.
Don Matzett, former host of this program, was also also equally, kind of in equal time, a golfer. Very good golfer, by the way. And he used to say that out on the golf course, there were lots of four-letter words being used by the people that he'd spend time with. And only, he never really bothered him, unless he heard someone take the name of Christ, the name of God, in vain. And then he said, then the argument would begin. But the other things, except for using the Lord's name in vain, he didn't allow it to faze him. Was he on the right track?
I think so. I mean, I don't like to be around rude and crude people. I grew up on the streets. I can deal with rude and crude people. I've frankly been rude and crude a couple of times myself in my life. But that's different from calling upon God. And it's different also from Christian sanctification. Again, we need to make sure that we understand the difference between growing in the image of Christ and being a gentleman or a lady. They're not the same thing. One is a cultural value. Being a gentleman and lady is a cultural value. Its content is defined by our culture. What it means to grow as a disciple into the image of Christ is defined by God and His Word, not by our culture. We sometimes here in America, we have the tendency to confuse those two.
Jerry calls from South County. Jerry, thanks for waiting.
Yeah, hi, Todd, and hi to your guests. What about the oaths that are used in the Masons and secret societies, the pagan gods? They're written about, like, books by Ed Decker, John Ankerberg.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Jerry. What about these? They kind of fall into a different category, but they are these are sometimes blood-curdling oaths that are taken ostensibly in the name of the Christian God.
Well, to be honest, I know nothing of them in any specific detail, so I can't speak to them specifically, but I will speak to them generally. If they use the name of God or call upon God to do something that is inconsistent with what God has revealed about Himself or about His will or about His teaching, then they are breaking the commandment. Just like the preacher who preaches false doctrine from the pulpit is breaking this commandment. Just to call upon God to do something that's contrary to God's revealed nature and will is a violation of the commandment.
What about the linguistically corrupted forms? Jeepers, creepers, geez, gosh, golly, darn it, heck. We've got, I mean, for almost every single word, we've got a kind of a linguistically corrupted form that people toss around all the time.
Well, if you know that those words are euphemisms for
the name of God,
the name of God, then you're breaking the commandment by using them.
All right, that's simple enough.
I mean, you know, it may be that someone simply doesn't know, just like they didn't know that goodbye was a shortened form of God be with you, or that Thursday is the day of Thor. If they have no idea what it is they're saying, in effect, then you really can't say they're taking God's name in vain. They're simply saying something that's meaningless to them.
I often tell my kids that I got all my cussing out of the way when I was a teenager, young and stupid. And not always with great success, but I try to keep my language as clean as possible in public, obviously. Clean by cultural standards, and especially around my family, around my kids. I don't want my kids growing up talking people on the streets. I don't want that to happen. Should I just kind of cut loose and let the four-letter words fly tonight when I get home, since technically I'm not breaking the second commandment?
If the four-letter word is love, that wouldn't be a bad thing. But no. In saying that there's a difference between social standards of being a gentleman and a lady and sanctification, we shouldn't understand that as saying that being a gentleman or lady is a bad thing. I actually think gentlemanly behavior is a good thing for all sorts of good social reasons, and parents might want their children to grow up to be gentlemen and ladies for all sorts of good, valuable social, cultural reasons. It's, you know, you want decent people who treat one another decently, who speak decently as well. Those are very good, but they're civil virtues. They're not virtues, the virtues of Christ and the gospel.
Okay, so that we not would not be misunderstood, and I know we will be, but so we'd not be misunderstood.
We're recording this, right?
Yes, finally, so we can go back to the record. What do you say to someone who has been listening and who says, look, my pastor, when I was growing up, taught me that these four-letter words were breaking the second commandment?
Well, I would say that he was trying to teach you the right thing. He just sort of took the wrong road to get you there. That is to say, if we're talking about common vulgarities now and not about oaths, lying, and so forth taken in the name of God, that he was trying to teach you something good. Maybe he got there by the wrong road, but he got to the right place in the end. You know, because he didn't want you to perhaps call the gospel into disrepute through your language or behavior, because that's not a good thing. Now, maybe he didn't explain it quite rightly. Maybe he attributed it to the wrong commandment. He may have made a technical theological error.
An exegetical error. There,
right.
Yes.
But that's not a sin. You know, it's not a sin to make a mistake in exegesis. Otherwise, you know, my poor students would be in a lot of trouble all the time.
Oh, yes, they'd have much bigger problems than simply a bad grade from Dave Adams.
No, but no. So, you know, I've done this. I probably did this when I was a young pastor as well, when I hadn't studied as much as I study now. I probably said the same thing. And to the extent that it's an application of the principle that one should use one's language and tongue and whole person in a way that brings glory to God, it's an adequate application. Does that help?
Yes, it helps a lot. Dr. David Adams is Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, author of the forthcoming Concordia Commentary on Genesis. Dr. Adams, it's always a pleasure, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
When the email comes in, I'll make sure I point it all your direction.
And it will join the 250 other emails I haven't had a chance to answer yet.
I hear what you're saying. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.